Rather than say, hey, what's up? You say Happy New Year. So, Happy New Year. You know, New Year's is a, for me, culturally, a very important event. I think it's probably one of the most important holidays in Japan, although there are many, many of them. And although I was raised Japanese American, New Year's was the thing that I looked forward to more than Christmas or Thanksgiving or my birthday, because it is a time for renewal. So, for example, you know, in Japan, there's this whole like set of rituals that people do: clean your entire house, inside and out. You eat special food. You ring the bell 108 times, which is kind of a Buddhist thing, but you know, it's not all people in Japan are Buddhist. Not all, certainly not all Japanese Americans are Buddhist. And I think you're supposed to ring the bell 107 times before midnight and one time after midnight, kind of purge or kind of cleanse yourself of the human sins and open the new year with a new bell. I sound like I'm really kind of into the Japanese thing. I should say, growing up Japanese American, New Year's was, if you can imagine, an 8-foot table filled every square inch with lacquer boxes full of special food. Then you can understand my sense of ecstatic joy. And it's pretty hard to get that kind of stuff down here. I mean, it's all homemade, and you can't really buy that, most of the stuff in a store. And so I've kind of settled for just having mochi, or, you know, kind of fresh rice cakes in the new year. But I think about the rest of what should be on the 8-foot table. So, you know, the last time I was up here, I read a children's book with Patrice, and I'd like to now kind of go back to doing a lecture, although I'd like to kind of do it somewhat differently than I normally have done in the past up here. By the way, for those of you, if you don't know me, my name is Dana Takagi, and I'm a priest here, although I haven't been here that much the last year. And here's what I'd like to do. I think the last time I was here, I said I had a lecture about modesty, and I would like to talk about modesty this evening. And really the kind of layer of modesty, individual and kind of collective, that's implied in Zen practice, although typically we don't use the word modesty in Zen. But it was something that both Catherine and Jean have trained me very deeply in. And I think although we don't talk about it, we should at least acknowledge that part of this practice is to, in some ways, you know, change our worldview. And particularly since Buddhism is an Eastern faith that comes from culturally very distinctive sets of values than, say, Western American liberalism. I think, you know, part of that package comes with a set of values and ethics that often we're not very explicit about. So I just want to be a little bit more explicit about one of those things tonight, which is modesty. You know, I had the occasion many times last year to teach introduction to people who wanted to learn mindfulness. That's what I get called about, mindfulness. Dana, will you come and teach this unit at the university, mindfulness? And, you know, for those of you who have been in Soto Zen for a while, we haven't historically said what we're doing here is mindfulness. We say that, you know, the core practice that we do is that differentiates Soto Zen from other kinds of Zen and Buddhist practices is Zazen. But, you know, I'm good. I roll with it. And one of the things that I've had to do when I go out and teach mindfulness or meditation, usually I say, you know, I'm not a great specialist in mindfulness, but I can teach meditation, and I can even lead a guided meditation, which again is not something that we do, right? Some of you may have had experiences of a guided meditation in other contexts. And the one thing that I try to communicate are these really very basic, simple, but demanding ways that I think it's important to think about meditation in general. Otherwise, it becomes just this, I don't know, I think it's very easy to fold meditation into kind of our usual practices of being busy, making lists, having, you know, an achieving or aspiring, gaining mind. So the one thing I always try to say to new groups, and really to people who have been practicing for a while, is try not to treat this like everything else that you do. Make this thing, whether it be Zazen or meditation or what some people would call mindfulness, make this thing the gateway door in your life that changes how you think about your relationship to yourself, your relationship to life in general, and death, and also to the world, because I think that's what's involved when you think about the translation of Buddhism, say, for example, from 9th century to 12th century Japan to 21st century Western nations like the United States. So I think, you know, basically what we're talking about is a sea change in culture and mindset for how we think about the world. And it really kind of goes against a lot of the very habitual, kind of almost autonomic ways that we have been taught to think about our life. And to understand what you're doing with your breath, and in Zazen, is to step back from this kind of overarching, I would call it a Western framework, on nature, on humanity, on the nature of being. And I think, you know, I have been kind of chewing on this question lately. What are the big questions that are most important for people? And it's a little odd maybe for me to kind of bring up the topic of modesty, but I'll just tell you really quickly how I came to this. And that is that I know that many of us study texts, sutras, we go to classes, we read on our own. I myself have a rather unruly and sprawling private study. And one of the things that I have been reading over the last couple of years has been academic scholars who read and write classical Japanese and Chinese, or classical Chinese really is what it is, and do these translation of texts. And one of the things that we find when we read these people is they say, you know, this sutra, that text, the founding of this monastery, the building of this practice, it has a very kind of uneven development. And it wasn't just written simply as, for example, the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. It wasn't quite, you know, there are edits, there are, you know, many different versions of these sutras by many different people that have many different meanings and so on. So these translation issues in my mind have been very important. So one of the things that I'd like to differently as I talk, and I want to thank the practice committee and Kokyo for inviting me to give a series of talks. I will be talking about once a month here for the next 6 months. And I want to kind of build a continuum around the ethical values that are implicit and sometimes explicit, but mostly implicit in Zen practice. So the first one that has come up for me is modesty. And I'll just give you kind of a couple of examples of why I think this is important. And I'll probably leave a lot unanswered. And something for us to kind of think about together and maybe chew on together. So one of the reasons that the modesty issue has come up for me is that, you know, I try to think about the forms, the texts, the practice of Zazen, and I feel like what we're doing is training or entraining one another to be modest about our relationship to life and our relationship to ourself in particular and our relationship to the world more generally. And what I mean by modest is, I suppose you might call it something like don't know mind. But I know that in this kind of this current climate, there's a lot of need for certainty. And I don't think it's really just this climate. I think this is something that has building sociologically over the last 40 years or so, that we have a need to know. Why did we get cancer? Why did we experience this sorrow with our parents' death or our friend's death? There's a lot of kind of genealogy that we're interested in as practitioners. About sometime last year, I had the occasion to participate in a Jukai ceremony. A Jukai ceremony is the giving of the precepts to an individual. Everybody here that has a little bib on, and maybe some people who don't have bibs or aren't currently wearing their bibs, took the precepts. And it's we call it a lay ordination. And you know, when we practice the precepts, as we do virtually every month, there's a precepts renewal ceremony that takes place here in the Zendo. We recite the precepts as a way to renew them. And like everything else in Zen, there are different versions of the precepts. And at this particular precept ceremony that I was involved in, the ordinands, the people who were being lay ordained, during the rehearsal said something like, "Oh, we don't want to do those precepts. Can we do the positive ones?" And we don't generally practice or kind of recite the positive ones here because it's actually kind of a long thing to remember. But for example, you know, the first precept is I vow not to take life or I vow not to kill. And the addendum to that on the positive version is but to cherish all life. I believe these, as some of the other teachers in here might know better than I, that these come from Mel Weitzman. We got to the precept, I vow not to praise myself. Here we say it as I vow not to praise self at the expense of others, which I've always thought is kind of redundant. If you vow not to praise self, then you won't do it at the expense of others. Anyway, I vow not to praise myself and downgrade others, but to maintain modesty, putting others first. And for some reason, when I heard that at this ceremony a year ago, it's just really that word modesty has really stuck with me. So I'll just give you a couple of examples of this, and then I don't know if I feel like I have to fill up a lot of extra time. I'll read some other stuff to you, but that's not my intention. I really want to just put modesty on the discussion table for what we're doing here. I'll just give you a couple quick examples and then we can have some discussion, question and answer if you like. Last fall, I ran into one of the priests from here, and she said to me, well, this is where it happens, Zen, in the grocery store. She said, you know, Dana, I'm going to this concert, this jazz concert down at the Watsonville Buddhist Church. Do you want to come with? And I said, sure. And it turned out to be a friend of mine who was playing. And so I had this experience of going to this Buddhist church, and the person sitting next to me said at one point, gee, I feel a little self-conscious. I'm the only not Japanese person pretty much in this whole church. And I thought she managed that very well. But as we kind of went through like two sets of jazz, and this particular band plays Japanese children's songs that have been sort of ramped up into a jazzy version, and then they tour, if you remember the earthquake and tsunami that occurred in Japan many, many years ago, they tour the Tohoku region of Japan to give back to community groups. And so, and then they run these concerts here on the mainland to raise money so that they can go tour in in this part of Japan. And, you know, it took about, the whole thing was about 2 hours, and it suddenly dawned on me that I was in a Buddhist temple, like I didn't really notice. And that all these people around me who looked kind of like my mother and father or sister, they identified as Buddhist even though they never said it. I mean, the kind of the reverend for the minister for the temple got up and said a few things and kind of, you know, asked us to donate money and that kind of thing. And it was really interesting what arose in me, which was I felt a need to say that I too was a Buddhist. And so finally, which is, you know, my big frickin' ego, having to say, no, I am too. And I did say to someone who was, you know, selling little bits of sushi, oh yeah, so when are services? And she just said, oh, there's Sunday at this time. And that was it, you know, and that's not kind of that's not the recognition that I'm used to. Or kind of a context that I'm used to in terms of Soto Zen, because it's very, like, we know one another, we see one another, we recognize and identify each other by robes or because it's a fairly small community and we know each other. And just that kind of recognition of what was very familial and cultural to me was sort of a new thing for me. And I've had this a couple times when I've been to Jodo Shinshu temples for funerals, for example. You know, I've watched very closely how they, how the priests do the service and what happens. And it's a very, it's just a different cultural context. So the other couple examples that I just want to give are, you know, when I first came to Santa Cruz Zen Center, I think it wasn't until I got a rakusu, which was about 3 years in, and I had gone and asked Catherine for the precepts, that she agreed that I was worthy of a job. And on a very limited basis, maybe I could be Doan. At that time, Doan was a much less demanding job in the sense that you rang 3 bells and then you rang the end of the period and she did an exit bow and so on. But Patrice Mansour trained me to ring the bells and I probably worked at it for 50 to 100 hours. And what they said to me was, let us know when you think you've got it. And I wanted to make sure I really had it, you know, which I didn't. But it was an interesting kind of relationship to a job here. It wasn't You know, it's not like, hey, anybody can do this. It was like, Dina, you need to work at this. And, you know, I would ring the bells and Catherine would say, well, not bad. And it was a very humbling experience, you know. I wanted to be a good Zen student and she wasn't going to give it to me until she felt that the bells sounded right or that she felt that I got it. And then the other example I want to give is when Beata and I were ordained in 2009. Catherine first said something like, welcome to the cult, in a joking, facetious way that she used to do. And then she said, and try to remember now, you're nobody. And you won't do service for at least a year. I don't even want you to jiko or doan. I just want you to just sit on the ton. And it was a very, you know, it was a kind of a profound teaching moment. And, you know, it's sort of impolitic to say, a year? Really? A year? Are you kidding? Because, you know, in her mind, she's probably adding time as you raise the question. But it was really this, for me, it was an instruction on how to be, that the higher you go, the less you are in some ways. And, you know, I, for me, you know, the teaching of the kind of basic precepts, and I don't mean just literally the precepts, but the kind of ethics and value of Zen came partly through these kind of training interactions that I had with Catherine and also with Jean. Also with Jean. You might have noticed that the way I offer incense is the way Jean offers incense, which is a kind of bow before you hit the center of the altar and bow to the right of the altar. I could go on maybe about modesty or being modest as a kind of form of Zen practice. I mention modesty because I think, you know, I hear a lot of these days here and other places things about accomplishments, kind of gaining things, like I will become ordained, I will get a rakusu, my 5-year plan is this and this and this. And I just wanted to say that that hasn't been my experience of it. And that it's been a very profound thing to say, okay, I'm just going to sit on the ton and try not to be anybody or try not to think so much of myself. Because there is this way in which when you get a rakusu or you get a priest robe, you feel like you did something. And it's a really hard thing to go back and say, no, I'm actually still a pretty ordinary person. So why don't I stop there? And so I didn't really have to. I brought my stack of books here to look scholarly. I say that somewhat facetiously, but I really think that, you know, there's just, we're doing some basic stuff here. And for me, it's helpful to name it as such. So thank you. Also, you know, we can do questions or we can go. And I will say that as part of my idea over the next 6 months, there will be some nights I might actually not take questions and just say, we'll go. But for tonight, it's been a while. It's a happy new year. We're now done with Christmas and holidays and family and friends and all that stuff that comes with the long period from Thanksgiving to Christmas. So would anyone like to have some conversation? Richard.
It seems to me that with practice in a normal flow, that humility is part of the fruit of practice. it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of being aware of it. But I'd like to think that if we practice full-heartedly, that that's something that, and just the tag of that thought is my sense of when I'm around someone that I feel is, I would say, I think this person is worthy of teaching me. One of the things I'm sensing is, two things I sense. One is that when I'm around them, I feel good about myself because I think they're seeing me at my best. And the other is that they're not arrogant, but it's a humility, which is a requirement.
Thank you, Richard. Did I see Mary's hand up? Mary.
You did. Thank you. It's always nice to have you back, Diane.
Nice to see you.
Sorry if that's praise, but that's how I feel. I'm quite how to interpret I will not praise self at expense of others, as opposed to leading off at expense of others.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to leading off the last phrase, at expense of others.
Uh-huh.
I think most of us in the room have had to struggle with something or another at one time or another. And sort of finally you get it and you, I don't know about overcome, but however it is you've managed this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious as to why it's not okay to say, that was tough, you did a good job. To yourself. You don't maybe tell that to others, but am I misunderstanding that?
Yes. I think there is so much, kind of degradation of self in Western culture that comes maybe karmically from families or work situations. And we often feel like we're not, this is part of kind of the Western psychic dilemma. I'm not good enough. So I don't think it's a bad thing to say, I think I did that okay. It's a different thing to put it on Facebook that you did okay.
Right.
And I think that's the line that I'm trying to think about. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Is that helpful for
yes,
you?
It is.
All right. Thank you. Did you want to follow up?
No.
Okay.
I think
I got it. Yarrow.
Pointing, noticing, and kind of having this aversion to something that's going on, it automatically tends to put you in this different position. Right?
Yes, yes.
It just kind of automatically, there's them kind of down there, and then you're somehow a little bit above that, that you wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But as, getting older, just noticing that, kind of the next level of that is they're doing something that, I don't, a quality in myself that I kind of don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of it's more of a reflection
mm-hmm.
of a discomfort in me
mm-hmm.
Rather than something going on out there.
So is that what you say? I'm uncomfortable with this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
To yourself or to them? I think it's very challenging right now because I think there are a lot of people that we love to hate right now. And we don't feel bad about that we love to hate them or that we love to be critical of them. I am on Twitter a lot, so I see some of the basest and sometimes very funny things. But I think that, like, I don't know what will happen, and I don't know is becoming more of a lost part of our relationship to the world. And I know I participate in this too. A couple years ago I was up here talking about starvation in Yemen. And I know a lot of people are kind of like, Yemen? You know, it's so far away, but, you know, kind of the level of global misery is really quite stunning right now. And I think many of us, we kind of almost automatically go to, well, if this and this and this were different, that level of misery would be better or might be better. And I, honestly, I don't know if that's true myself. So, anyway, thank you, Yaro. Corinne.
Once ordained, being reminded that you're nobody, that nobody, so that the fullness of who you really are can come in.
Say again.
Can come in, can arise.
Mm.
So I think that the practice of modesty encourages that. Seeing your actions in life as being not individually driven, but as a composite.
I'm not sure I fully understand what you're saying.
Yeah. It's not a negation, it's an opening. And it's not, unlike what Kopia was talking about last week with Val.
Mm-hmm.
And what came to mind to me about Val is that phrase in one of, I think it's Frost's poems, when he's awake in the night, and he talks about vows being made for me, like the whole experience was vow, or vows, if you could say that. It wasn't I making this vow.
That's very generous of you. I don't think Catherine meant it that generous way. I think she just meant, don't try to pretend you know what you're doing.
No,
right now, because
you're not doing anything.
Right. I don't know that she meant it as an opening. I think, you know, she wanted to make sure that the ego did not rise. And that maybe in that moment an ancillary plus would be there, would be this opening. I don't know. I mean, she's not here to ask, unfortunately. But,
sounds like back to basics.
Yeah. Do you know that David White poem, the lines of which I won't remember exactly right now, but there's a poem in which he says, it's about facing yourself and make a vow that no one will hear that will kill you to forget. Yeah. Kind of implying that the private vows are the ones that are really significant or potent for us. Thank you. Kathy?
Yeah, there's an edge to this.
An itch or an edge? Oh, okay.
Edge. in my experience where, on the one hand, I am eternally grateful for the ways that Catherine pulled the rug out from under my ego, which is significantly large. And, you know, I treasure the teachings, like when I, just before I got ordained and I said, what should I do? She said, just shovel compost. And that was like one of the best teachings I ever got.
Mm-hmm.
So I in no way want to dishonor or unappreciate that.
Yeah.
At the same time, she and I had some struggle about, like, for example, when she took it to the level of, you know, you should consider maybe not writing. Not writing.
Writing.
You know, Lou's teacher told him not to write.
Mm-hmm.
As if the act of writing, and this is a person who threw away and destroyed her own art.
Yes.
You know, as if this act of actually having the audacity to think you have something to say.
Right.
Or something to offer.
Right.
Might somehow be egotistical.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's a right and wrong here. It's a koan, and it's a, but for me there's a real edge in there. And it's something, I mean, I still struggle with, you know, having a body of work now that I want to publish. But there's a part of me that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking with a person about, you know, the publishers, they want to see how many followers you have. Like, I don't want any followers.
Right.
That makes me just sad. That sounds horrible. I don't want followers. Do I want readers? Yeah. Do
right.
I want comrades in sharing ideas?
Right.
Sure. So, and yet, you know, you come out into the field, in a Facebook-y field, and it's about followers.
Right.
And hits and likes. So it's a little scary and overwhelming and has kept me from putting myself out in that way, and yet there's a concurrent impossibility to not put it out. And I don't know, I know you've dealt in the public field some and the realm where people put out ideas, and is there anything you could help me with?
I would just say that my own experience in academia is that it's pretty easy to get sucked into this. So that once you become a published author, then you do book tours. And then people want to listen to my own personal experiences. You know, I have an expertise in a very kind of esoteric field of law related to affirmative action. And it's the kind of thing where most people, like if I started lecturing on that, you would all be asleep. I would cure your insomnia. You would be gone. But because I had a book that won awards, I got invited to go to a lot of universities and the educational test, you know, all kinds of things that made me feel important. And it's hard to resist that. I stopped giving talks because I found it too much of a game. But I think, you know, money's at stake and ego is at stake, and it's pretty hard to stay conscious of it, I think. That's not an admonition that you shouldn't enter into it, but I just think, you know, it's those areas where it's not very conscious and you just slip into these habitual ways of, yes, of course I'll fly there, and of course for this amount of money I'll talk to your students and the dean and the public and blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, in my case at the university, advancement depended on your making an original significant impact to the world. You become a tenured professor because you contribute original research to a national scholarly discipline, and you become a full professor if you contribute, you can show, demonstrate international impact. That kind of broadly. And so, you know, it is a track, and how I think people do navigate it. So I think, I just want to say it's a track, and you'll have to be careful of it,
well,
whichever way you go, right?
And that fear of that is what's kept me from putting anything out, to be honest. It sounds terrible. It sounds like a, you know,
Fear of your own ego rising, or fear of...
Well, you know, I aspire for more anonymity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to come here and just sit. You know, sometimes I wish I could just do that.
Yeah.
Or to just walk in the road, you know, world.
I feel
you. You know.
Yeah.
Sometimes the favorite way I have of being a priest is when I don't have my robes on.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm doing priest work.
Right.
I know I'm doing priest work. Mm-hmm. I'm on a t-shirt and, you know, mm-hmm. yoga pants.
Mm-hmm. Yay for t-shirts and yoga pants. You know, I had this experience at the university where just on my way to tenure, I happened to write what I considered to be a throwaway essay. And it got reprinted so many times that I got sick of seeing it. So I called the publisher and I said, no more. You're making money off of it. Maybe I'm making money off of it, but no more. And he just, we had an argument about it. You know, he said, you're crazy. I go, I just can't perform that person. I wrote this thing in like a day and a half, and it's not really even what I do, but whatever. And then, you know, there is also the experience, and I'm sure you know this as a writer, Kathy, that there are a lot of people who do beautiful work who don't get recognition. And the same thing in Zen. There are a lot of people, deep practitioners, who don't ordain or priest ordain, and who, and maybe have refused to do that, but who are as deep a practitioner as any of the practice leaders. So.
Can I say one thing?
Yes.
So, that reminds me of a beautiful thing I just read this morning. I'm reading a book by Charles Eisenstein that I'm really enjoying, and he talked about he made mention of, you know, the quiet people, the kindergarten teachers, and the you know, the people who aren't famous. And he says they're actually holding the fabric of the world together.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that to be true. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it isn't important to do big things, but the quiet people, the people who are in the background, people who are changing bedpans, teaching little children and things like that, are holding the fabric of the world together. And what else must go around and try to figure out how to save the world?
I think all of us are those quiet people. But sometimes we get a little taken with we're better or immodest about our quietness. Thank you.
You know, I'm just compelled to do one. Can I?
Okay.
That with this idea of modesty and humiliation, there has to also be
humility, not humiliation. We're not going for humiliation.
Humility. Sorry. Yeah. that just very apropos of what Kathy's bringing up is that I think now more than almost at any time that I've been alive, we need people not to be squelching their gifts, their what they have to offer, and that the way that can be done, that we can share our genius or, you know, what we really have to offer is through humility and modesty. That's the way to do it. So that, to me, it's, I don't see an edge or a contradiction. I see that your call to do it, please do it. And the way, the path to it is selflessness. So I see them married. I don't want people to not express themselves, especially now. We're all called.
These are very, you know, individual kinds of decisions that we make about kind of the choices around occupation, futures, practices in our life. And I think of these sometimes like how we talk about the precepts, which is we embrace the precepts and we break them. And in between there is where we live. And So how about, can we call this now? I had actually intended for us to be out of here by 7:10. Oops. So, and I thought the comments were great for everyone. So thank you to everybody who asked. And if you wanted to ask a question or make a comment and didn't get a chance to, be out on the patio for tea. So thank you very much. Bing-dong.